Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Supreme Court decision on the Christian fundamentalist baker who refused to make a wedding cake for a gay couple, and discuss the ruling with Rachel Lazar, the president and CEO of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. She joins us to discuss her article at The Advocate, "We Can Protect Religious Liberty Without Denying Rights to LGBT People," and how the Do Not Harm Act, co-sponsored by Senator Kamala Harris and Congressman Joseph Kennedy, would fix the main issues involved in this case, which the Supreme Court did not address in their narrow ruling. We will also examine Project Blitz, the legislative assault underway in state legislatures by Christian nationalists to reshape America, which has brought forward 75 In God We Trust bills in more than 20 legislatures using the claim of imaginary attacks on religious freedom to impose their narrow Christian fundamentalist dogma on the American public to dictate our political and cultural life. With a Christian fundamentalist televangelist asking his flock to pony up $54 million for him to fly around in a top-of-the-line Gulfstream private jet, it hardly seems possible that the Congressional Prayer Caucus Foundation's justification for Project Blitz is based on the absurd notion that Christians in America are oppressed and that Sharia law is about to be imposed on these beleaguered believers. Then, with President Trump touting last month's job numbers, we will go to the UK to speak with David Graeber, a professor of anthropology at the London School of Economics, about his new book just out, Bullshit Jobs, A Theory. We will discuss how up to 40% of the working public believe their jobs are pointless, a view held in both the private and public sector, and that less than half of their time spent working involves actual work. We will discuss the paradox that the more valuable your work is to society, the less you are paid for it, and as robotics replace repetitive manual labor, the need for a guaranteed universal basic income begins to look more necessary. Then finally, following today's barrage of petulant protestations in tweets from Trump claiming he has, quote, the absolute right to pardon himself, and that the Mueller investigation is led by, quote, 13 very angry and conflicted Democrats, is totally unconstitutional. We will speak with Brian Colt, a professor of law at Michigan State University, about his article in Foreign Policy written over a year ago, Can Trump Pardon Himself? We will analyze both Trump's and his TV lawyer Rudy Giuliani's claims of the presidential right to self-pardon, which they claim is supported by numerous legal scholars. And joining us now is Rachel Lazar, the president and CEO of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, a lawyer. She has spent the past two decades fighting for inclusivity for all Americans, and she has an opinion piece at The Advocate, "We Can Protect Religious Liberty Without Denying Rights to LGBT People." Welcome to Background Briefing, Rachel Lazar.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Well, thank you, Rachel. And the Supreme Court released their findings in the case Masterpiece Cake Shop versus Colorado Civil Rights Commission. The headlines today are largely about a Christian baker winning at the Supreme Court. It doesn't appear to be quite that simple. How would you describe the outcome?
Yeah, I mean, I think the outcome is mixed, but it's definitely a shell of a victory, if you want to call it a victory, for Masterpiece Cake Shop. Technically, the court reversed the lower court's opinion and did rule on the side of Masterpiece Cake Shop, but they ruled on a very, very narrow ground where they found that the Colorado Civil Rights Commission's hearing was biased, and therefore that they weren't able to find for Charlie Craig and David Mullins on that specific basis that's particular to the fact pattern in this case. And what was great about this case, because it was 7-2, is that means that in the seven justices, for the majority, were all of the conservative justices. And all of the conservative justices agreed multiple times throughout this decision that when a business is open to the public, that means it's open to all. And that's very significant. Another thing that's significant is that while the court did technically rule on the side of Masterpiece Cake Shop, that the court does not say that businesses are entitled to distort the concept of religious freedom to deny services to couples like Charlie and David.
Well, it seems like they dodged that whole issue of the conflict between religious bakers and same-sex couples.
I mean, courts, you know, the Supreme Court looks for ways to rule on as narrow grounds as possible, especially in very controversial decisions. And here, you know, they, whenever they're able to find a way, which is, you know, not all the time, as you know, to have any kind of significant majority and narrow their ruling at this level, they do it. And that's what they seem to do here. But I will say that Justice Kagan, who was joined by Justice Breyer in her concurring opinion, strongly hinted that in the absence of these comments about religion that were made by a couple of members of the Colorado Civil Rights Commission, that this case would have come out in favor of the couple.
Well, in the majority opinion, Anthony Kennedy made it clear that he's unwilling to restrict the rights of gay people in order to enhance the privileges of conservative Christians. But there's still four other justices who would rule that way, as far as I can tell.
Do you think? Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, sort of, but at the same time, you know, here's an opinion that, and I'll quote from it, where the court recognized that disputes such as this one in Masterpiece must be resolved. And now here's the quote, without subjecting, they say gay persons, I'll say LGBTQ persons, to indignities when they seek goods and services in an open market. So there you had all seven justices who were saying that in the last sort of forceful paragraph of the opinion. So, you know, there was some recognition of the how we've evolved and that when businesses are open, that means open to all, including people who identify as gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, et cetera. So that's wonderful, that part.
So obviously, though, Hobby Lobby opened the door, did it not, that decision to the idea that corporations have rights above, in effect, in the case of Hobby Lobby, it was more important that their private corporation should be able to exempt itself from the Affordable Care Act. So how would you relate this decision to, say, Hobby Lobby?
Yeah, I'm really glad that you raised that. You're right. Hobby Lobby ruled that a business, a corporation, could have sincerely held religious beliefs that could deprive women employees of birth control, even though the Affordable Care Act had promised it to them. Here, the court didn't specifically take up this question of whether businesses can have sincerely held religious beliefs. But in a sense, there was, in my view, some kind of an acceptance of that notion, right? Just even in, you know, looking, it was almost implicit in looking at how the baker, Jack Phillips, was treated by the commission. You know, some could say, you know, it was sort of, it's inapposite how the commission treated Jack Phillips's religious beliefs, because when Jack Phillips incorporated, he intentionally created distance between his personal self and his personal assets and this bakery. And now he wants to use it both ways, right? And he wants to say he's personally intertwined with his business in a way that his business now has some kind of religious, sincerely held beliefs. And that is very much like Hobby Lobby. It's just that here the court didn't reach that officially. The court said, in any case, we think that there was a bias in the way the Civil Rights Commission in Colorado conducted its hearings. And so that's why we need to reverse the decision today.
And again, I'm speaking with Rachel Lazar, who's the president and CEO of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, a lawyer. She has spent the past two decades fighting for inclusivity for all Americans, and she has an opinion piece at The Advocate, "We Can Protect Religious Liberty Without Denying Rights to LGBT People." So in terms of your article, when you say we can protect people without denying rights to LGBT people, I take it you're talking about what Kamala Harris and Joseph P. Kennedy are offering up in both the House and Senate, the Do No Harm Act. Is that what you're referring to?
That is what I'm referring to.
Could you tell us about what this act does, if it, assuming it, you know, it's obviously you've got a Republican House and a Republican Senate. It's not obviously going to have an easy passage unless there's a change in November. But what does it do, the Do No Harm Act?
Yes. So the Do No Harm Act ensures that our nation's main religious freedom law, which is called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, is used as a shield, as it was intended to protect religious exercise, not as a sword to harm and discriminate against others. So technically, it amends this religious freedom law, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, to say that in certain areas, when it comes to child labor and protection, when it comes to discrimination laws, when it comes to healthcare laws, places where we've seen religion claimed as a license for discrimination, that religion can't be used to harm other or hurt other people. And to bring this religious freedom law back to its original purpose, so to leave a lot of it intact, which is it originally came about based on a very broad religious coalition, really across political spectrums, joining the civil rights community to say, in our country, we have religious minorities who need additional protections. They might want to wear religious attire that would otherwise be banned. They might want to take their religious holidays off, but because they're in the minority, these holidays aren't recognized, and we should have protections for religious freedom for these religious minorities in these ways. And of course, religious freedom protects all of our religious beliefs, whether we're in the minority or in the majority. But what it doesn't do, and what it shouldn't do, which would violate our core principle around it, is allow one religious group, and in the case of Masterpiece, it's a white fundamentalist Christian group, to impose their religious beliefs on the rest of us. So this law, the Do No Harm Act, is related to the Masterpiece Cake Shop decision very much because it's about ensuring that religious freedom is not twisted to cause harm to people, like what happened when the bakery denied Charlie and David their wedding cake. But it's different, the Do No Harm Act, in that it amends our main national religious freedom law, whereas the Masterpiece Cake Shop case was about the free exercise clause of our First Amendment.
Well, how would, if it were passed, and as I point out, it's a pretty uphill battle unless the House changes and the Senate changes in November. But meanwhile, I'd like to know how that, if it were passed, how it would impact what's going on at the state level with Project Blitz, which is a legislative assault by Christian nationalists to reshape America's laws. They have at least 75 bills have come forward in more than 20 states during 2017 and 2018. The group is called the Congressional Prayer Caucus Foundation, and they're clearly being successful in their so-called In God We Trust bills, a number of which have become law since 2017. And it's extraordinary to call it Project Blitz, because Blitz having echoes of Blitzkrieg, the Nazi war machine in World War II. So let's start with whether or not these state laws could be superseded by a federal law such as the Do No Harm Act.
Yeah, that would be tricky. I mean, I'd like to see, you know, the Do No Harm Act also passed across the states. The Religious Freedom Restoration Act was deemed by the Supreme Court not to apply to states, you know, the religious freedom bill that we were talking about, for example, before. And therefore, a lot of states then passed Religious Freedom Restoration Acts on their own, some of which were egregious and some bills which were so egregious that they actually never even became law, like one in Indiana, if you recall. I'm glad that you brought up Project Blitz, because Project Blitz is doing at the state legislative level what like a group like Alliance Defending Freedom, which is technically labeled a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center, is doing in the courts. So what Alliance Defending Freedom, which, by the way, has a budget of around $50 million a year, is doing is they're bringing a number of lawsuits in the courts to try to allow businesses the right to discriminate against, in particular, and really targeting people who identify as bisexual, gay, lesbian, transgender, queer, targeting women and their reproductive freedom, and frankly, many others who are swept into that, like religious minorities and other groups. So that's what Alliance Defending Freedom is doing in the courts. What Project Blitz is doing, as you said, is they've put together really a playbook, and it's 116 pages long, and it lays out a whole legislative strategy in the states to change the law step by step, to allow ultimately businesses and the government to discriminate in the name of religion. And, you know, we can talk, if you're interested, we can talk more about it. There are sort of three different phases of it, but it intentionally starts out with these very symbolic gestures, like "In God We Trust," sort of everywhere, including, let's say, like on police cars or something, that feel more harmless and, you know, are often less opposed. And then they start moving to bills intended to promote teaching Christianity. And frankly, I should say, you know, a fundamentalist Christian version of Christianity, because Christianity is very heterogeneous in public schools, and culminating in what I just said, which is businesses and frankly, trying to permit government employees as well to discriminate if they have, quote, sincerely held religious beliefs. So there is what we're seeing sort of overall in the country right now is this united strategy, right? It's coming as a legal strategy. It's coming as a legislative strategy. And by the way, we're also seeing it very much in the Trump-Pence administration as part of their regressive agenda. And so it's sort of everywhere, this strategy to really use religion as a basis, an excuse to stop social change, you know, and to sort of equalize the power dynamics in America as we're at this wonderful point in the American experiment of vibrant diversity.
Well, of course, the Christian right like to borrow from the martyrdom of Christ and make it seem like they're being oppressed and punished. And Trump plays into that by saying, oh, we can now, we're free to celebrate Christmas again. Like, you know, were we never prevented from celebrating Christmas? What kind of nonsense is that? And, you know, what they're talking about, in effect, is a form of Sharia law, the very thing that they rail against, even though it's a completely unrealistic possibility that the states of Oklahoma, which passed anti-Sharia laws, would ever be forced to get rid of the Bible and take up the Quran. I mean,
That's right. And I have a couple things to respond to your remarks with. One is, you're absolutely right. I mean, what we're seeing is a form of fundamentalist Christian fragility, really, which I liken to the concept of white fragility. That there's a scholar called Robin DiAngelo who's defined, you know, white people's reactions to being sort of challenged about racism. She's called it white fragility, where white people get defensive and they say they're the ones being attacked and the discrimination is against them. And right, it's a very similar pattern to what you see when fundamentalist Christians' power is challenged, right? Oh, we're the ones being attacked in a lawsuit that we're bringing right now against a school system, the Bossier Parish in Louisiana, who are proselytizing Christianity in their public schools. The students there have formed a movement, and you know what it's called? Protect prayer, as though their Christian prayer, which is so dominant in their setting, is what's in need of protection, right? It's sort of, it's the same thing that you're describing, this fragility, except right now we're really seeing it in the form of you know, fundamentalist Christian fragility. So that's, you know, so that's one reaction. And the other reaction is, you know, the Trump-Pence administration is as I said, using religion to discriminate sort of throughout their agenda. I mean, it started out with this rhetoric, you know, with this rhetoric from Trump of, oh, we should all be able to say Merry Christmas. But there's a blueprint for discrimination that came out of the Department of his Department of Justice that's now being implemented by a lot of the federal agencies, including HHS, where we've seen an interim final rule that allows bosses in universities to discriminate against women and deny them their birth control, which we've challenged in court, by the way. And there's sort of countless other ways. They in HHS, they have another rule where we filed comments where they want to allow discrimination in healthcare that would affect a lot of transgender people and women and really all of us, because it can be used, religion can be used as a basis to deny fertility treatments to an interfaith couple, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it can just be used for anyone's desire to discriminate against anyone in this society, which sort of collapses the American experiment, right? Which is sort of the goal. Sure. And I'll say a third thing, which is you raise Sharia law and anti-Sharia statutes. Well, the Trump's Muslim ban, where the Supreme Court is going to rule on that within the next month as well, that's another example of using religious freedom and twisting it to discriminate, right? Religious freedom means everyone is welcome here, sure, right? It means that we don't shut out one group of people based on their religious beliefs and practices like we did with Trump's Muslim ban. And so that's going to be another very significant decision in this space. And if you want to know what the connection is between the Muslim ban Supreme Court case and this Masterpiece Cake Shop case, it's largely that they're both about allowing one tiny fraction of America's religious community, which is this white fundamentalist Christian community, to impose their beliefs on the rest of us. So I think it's important that you brought up the sort of Muslims, because they're implicated in what's going on around religious freedom very much right now.
Well, Rachel Lazar, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Very nice to speak with you.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Rachel Lazar, the president and CEO of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, a lawyer. She has spent the last two decades fighting for inclusivity for all Americans, and she has an opinion piece at The Advocate. We can protect religious liberty without denying rights to LGBT people. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with President Trump touting last month's jobs numbers and the new study that finds 40% of the working public believe their jobs are pointless.
Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. A woman done left and took all the reason I was working for. You better not try to stand in my way as I'm walking out the door. Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is David Graeber, a professor of anthropology at the London School of Economics. He's the author of Debt, The First 5,000 Years, and a contributor to Harper's, The Guardian, and The Baffler. His latest book just out is Bull Bleep Jobs, A Theory. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Graeber.
Thanks for having me.
And for the purpose of this interview, since we're on public radio and the FCC, under pressure from the religious right in this country, mm-hmm. will levy a fine, I believe, of $250,000 if we use the title, your actual title of bull, .. jobs. So let's agree to call it the book BS Jobs. Is that okay?
Okay. Yeah, sometimes I say pointless jobs, useless jobs.
Right.
But BS Jobs.
Yeah, I think that it'll get the message across. And, of course, the religious right today had a victory in the Supreme Court with the wedding cake maker was vindicated for his bigotry. We'll deal with that later in the program. So let's talk about the general thesis of your book, because obviously I think in many ways your arguments are vindicated by the fact that robotics are becoming more and more ubiquitous, particularly in manufacturing. And now some countries like Switzerland are talking about a guaranteed minimum wage. So just to start, if you would, with your basic sense that 40% of jobs are meaningless, if not useless.
Yeah, well, this is something that it took me a while to figure out, because I thought the number was going to be much, much lower. It all started, I'm not really from a professional background. I find myself a professor. And, I'm an anthropologist by profession, but I also feel sort of like an anthropologist sort of traveling through these kind of circles. It's all very alien to me. And I keep running into people, at parties, faculty, spouses, people like that. And I say, well, what do you do? And they kind of say, oh, nothing really, And at first I assumed that they're just being modest. But if you press them, give them a few drinks and, what do you really do? Sometimes they will admit that they literally do nothing. They just maybe work 2 hours a week, and otherwise they sit there playing computer games or, going updating their Facebook profiles. And other people would admit to me that they feel their entire line of work shouldn't exist. So I wrote this little piece where I sort of said, well, they used to predict we would only have a 15-hour week by now. Back in the 30s, Keynes said, automation would largely replace most jobs. And maybe it actually did happen. Maybe technological unemployment, as they used to call it, actually occurred. But instead of just giving us more time, somehow we've contrived to just make up meaningless jobs so that everybody should be working, because everybody feels like they're so resentful of the idea that anybody isn't working. So, I wrote a little piece about this, and it was almost half a joke. I didn't know how true it really was. But the piece went crazy. It was published in a very obscure place, Strike Magazine, a radical paper that few people usually read. But, within 10 days, I think, it had been translated into 12 or 13 different languages. The site kept crashing. It was getting millions of hits. It started appearing in newspapers. People started writing these crazy confessionals, it's true. I'm a corporate lawyer. I contribute nothing to society. I'm miserable all the time. Talking about how much they suffer and how much, it really is, as they called it, a scar across our collective soul. Nobody talks about it. Eventually, this inspired a set of surveys, and the one here in the UK found that 37% of people said their jobs contributed nothing to the world. Holland, 40%. And it seems pretty consistent that most people feel their jobs are, at some point, but a pretty substantial minority, somewhere between a third and 40%, really feel that if their jobs didn't exist, it would make no difference, or else the world would actually be a slightly better place.
And again, I'm speaking with David Graeber, Professor of Anthropology at the London School of Economics. He's the author of Debt, The First 5,000 Years, and a contributor to Harper's, The Guardian, and The Baffler. And his latest book just out is B.S. Jobs, A Theory. And he joins us from London. But there must be some kind of cultural reason, or I'm not sure what it is. For example, the Japanese, you're forced to work long hours, whether you do any work or not, and it apparently has a terrible impact on home life, and parents rarely see their children, or particularly fathers, who tend to be the working stiffs. Here in the United States, people do work very hard, and they get very few vacations. I think it's like two weeks if they're lucky, not like the Europeans. And you're in London, I'm sure people get a much better deal there. And in general, at the moment, the president is celebrating the fact that there are, 223,000 new jobs this month. He tweets that out as much as he can. So we're really heading in terms of, and we can get to solutions or how we can reimagine ourselves out of this kind of doldrum. But at the moment, we are heading in the opposite direction from what your book points out, and we're not recognizing what your book's about, clearly.
Yeah, well, that's why I wrote it. I mean, it's crazy. And I think if you talk about cultural reasons why this happened, I think it's pretty clear. We have this rhetoric that it's we could have chosen more leisure, but instead we went for consumerism. But if you look at where these jobs are, they're not created by consumerism. It's not like people are all serving each other sushi or making iPhones. The number of people in actual service, is, you know, giving haircuts, serving coffee, has remained pretty much constant at 20% for the last 100 years. What's gone up is this sort of clerical, managerial, administrative work. There's often, you know, people who just sit in offices and do nothing all day. Now, why did that happen? Well, I think part of the reason is simply because it's the one thing the left and right both agree on, is that more jobs is always good. There's this huge rhetoric that everybody should be working as hard as they could, and they managed to really instill in us a sense that if you're not working harder than you want to be working at something you don't particularly enjoy, well, you're just a bad person. You know, you don't deserve anything. You don't, certainly don't deserve the love and support of your community or relief or anything like that. So it's partly a cultural thing. And it's partly, I think, you know, to be perfectly honest, I think it's a result of trickle-down economics. If you think about it, if left and right both agree more jobs is good, the sort of traditional left approach, which is what people did in the 50s, 60s, 70s even, was, you know, distribute more money to poor people or middle-class people and they'll buy stuff. And then people will hire people to make the stuff to sell them. But nowadays, they say, oh, rich people are job creators. They know best. Give the money directly to the rich people with tax cuts or whatever you do. Well, if you distribute money to rich people but you don't create a demand for products because nobody can afford them, well, what are they going to do? They're under pressure to create jobs. So they'll just hire flunkies. You know, they just hire somebody to do something. You're not going to produce more people to manufacture stuff nobody needs. So this is what happens. These corporations just fill with these guys who might as well be feudal retainers, you know, just sort of who exist to make powerful executives feel good about themselves.
So the more people you preside over, the better you feel about yourself. And apparently, if your research...
And more important you are.
Yeah. Exactly. But your research points out that this is not just the province of government jobs, that corporate jobs are just as useless as government jobs.
Exactly. And in fact, it's even worse. If you look at public universities versus private universities, overall in American universities over the last 35 years, I think it was. Someone looked into it. The number of professors and students have both gone up by about 50%. The number of administrators by 85. The number of administrative staff, who are basically, you know, the sort of flunkies and assistants of the administrators, have gone up 240%. Okay, so that's huge already. But the interesting thing for me is that the rate is twice as fast in the private universities as it is in the public ones.
Well, Mark Fisher has an idea that he calls it market Stalinism, where capitalism borrows from Stalinism in valuing symbols of achievement over actual achievement. So what about this old Marxist notion of from each according to his ability to each according to his needs? Maybe that's something to rediscover.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that we need to detach compensation and work. And I know it's like the most radical thing you could possibly say. But, you know, the fact is, at the moment, what we got is a system where there's an inverse relationship between the amount your work benefits other people and the amount you're paid. Because, you know, say what you like about garbage collectors, nurses,
school teachers.
What's that?
School teachers,
a good example. Yeah, they're not paid very much, but they certainly benefit society. And in fact, people have done breakdowns, and the most highly paid people in our society sometimes have negative value. They destroy value for every dollar they get. Doctors, there's a few exceptions. You know, there's always going to be a few exceptions. But even among doctors, someone pointed out to me recently that, you know, the doctor who is actually paid the most in the entire world, I believe, is an expert on anal bleaching. You know, so the doctors who actually do the useful doctoring get paid less than the ones who do completely silly things. All right. So at the moment it works that way. Well, you know, that's absurd, and we could invert it. Or maybe we can just stop saying we can measure what the social benefit of someone's work is and just give everybody the same. Just pay people first and then let them decide for themselves what they want to do and how they want to benefit society. You know, this is why I've come around for a position for universal basic income, because know, the usual objections are either people are lazy. If you just give them money and say go out and do something, they won't. They'll just sit at home and watch TV. Well, I think that one of the things that really strikes me about these BS jobs is the fact that people actually are being paid to do nothing, and you can see what happens. They're miserable. I mean, almost in every case, they report themselves to be completely unhappy, frustrated. They want to do something with their lives. I think that if there's ever proof that people, you know, really don't need to be compelled to contribute to society, that's it. And second of all, what they say is, well, if you just gave people money and said, here's an income, now go off and decide what you have to offer society, well, you know, that would be nice. That's human freedom, certainly, and we've never really even contemplated having a society that free. But people say, well, people are going to do silly stuff. I mean, so many of them are going to go decide they're poets or musicians. So, you know, the streets will fill with bad poets and annoying street musicians and crank scientists and so forth. Well, my answer to that is, well, 40% of people already think that they're doing nonsense. How can it be worse than we've already got? I don't think it'll be 40% of people who decide that they're going to be poets or musicians. I think, you know, a lot of them are going to do something just sort of obviously useful and helpful. And of the ones who do decide that they want to be scientists or musicians, well, all you need is like just one of them to be John Lennon or just one of them to be Einstein, and you know, you basically got your money back.
Right. And of course, if there's a whole bunch of bad pottery, people aren't necessarily going to buy it. But the idea that you
pile it up in the warehouse, whatever.
Right. But one of the examples you have in your new book, David Graeber, BS Jobs, A Theory, is there was a government worker in charge of a city's water treatment plant who decided his time was better spent at home studying his favorite 17th century writer. And he collected a salary for 6 years before anybody noticed.
Yeah. Yeah, but in his credit, you know, at first I thought, okay, this is very scandalous. But then when I heard the whole story, it made a lot of sense. Basically, what happened is his boss decided that he didn't like him, so he wouldn't give him any work. So he just had to sit there and pretend to work every day. And, you know, anybody ever has a real job knows that the worst part of a job is, you know, having to pretend you're working when there's nothing to do. But this guy, that's all he had to do, right? So he got really depressed. He went to his shrink. He said, what should I do? His shrink said, well, what do you think would be useful that you could do? Give your life a sense of purpose. And he said, Spinoza. I've always been fascinated by Spinoza. I want to become a Spinoza scholar. So, you know, he kind of came in. If there was a problem, he'd show up and take care of it. And otherwise, he just convinced one people in one office he was in the other one and vice versa and went home and wrote books.
Well, no one noticed. We have on local TV news here in Los Angeles, they have a so-called investigative reporter who goes around finding county workers sleeping in their trucks, and that's a big deal. You know, I mean, he would never go after Wall Street bandits and banksters, but they beat up on little guys, and they call it.
I know, it's so mean.
Yeah, they call it investigative.
What's wrong
journalism.
With that? Well, sometimes you need to hire people just in case there's a problem.
Right.
So what does it matter what they do when there isn't a problem?
Right, exactly. But it leads me, though, what you're just talking about, the idea of a guy not showing up to work. One of the biggest problems we have here in Los Angeles is enormous gridlock on the freeways, which contributes enormously to pollution because people sit for sometimes 2 to 3 hours, maybe 4 hours a day, just pumping CO2 into the air, stuck on a freeway. A lot of those people could work from home on their computers and send their work in, could they not?
And a lot of people said that, actually. This is interesting because, you know, a lot of people do have work, but it's really just 2 hours a week or maybe 1 hour a day. And quite a number of the testimonies, because I gathered testimonies of people who had these kind of jobs, several hundred. So I have a sense of what they're like. Yeah, a lot of people said exactly that. It's like, why do I have to put on a suit and drive to work every day? This is stupid. I could actually do this job from home in an hour. Problem, of course, is then people would know it only takes me an hour to do the job.
Well, maybe there's a way to send your work in pieces over an 8 hour span. But so is it at the end of the day, David Graeber, is it really simply about a lack of imagination and maybe some kind of Calvinist impulse that we have or the vestiges of it? I don't know. But you could imagine a really wonderful society in which people, you know, maybe they're making bad pottery, But they'd have a lot more time on their hands. They'd have spend a lot more time with their kids, you know. Yeah. And
you'd have a social life.
You know? Exactly, they'd have a social life, and there'd be no sense of guilt that you have to work and basically have to waste your life pretending to work, which is even, I think, more soul destroying.
I think for the last 25, 30 years, there's been a kind of a war on the human imagination. I think that there's been this incessant drumbeat that, like, nothing is going to change. We've figured it all out. This is the best it's going to get. You know, this sort of free market, like, financialized version of capitalism we now have is the only economic system that's ever going to work. Give up on your dreams of anything ever being different. And as a result, you know, once we face unprecedented problems, we just lack the ability to think big. And thus the dreams that our ancestors had, our grandparents, our great parents, you know, they hoped their grandchildren were going to be working in an age where we could all like work 10 or 15 hour weeks. And we could do that. But now we just lack the imagination to actually realize any of those things. The one point I always make, they say, okay, the current system, the sort of free market system, it might be, create problems, it might create inequality, it might make people work too hard or feel they work too hard, but it's efficient. Everybody says that. It's the most efficient economic system ever created. Anything else would be bad in comparison. Well, how efficient could it be if the prospect of eliminating unpleasant work by replacing them with robots is considered to be a problem? Like, why can't our economic system, if it's so efficient, just reallocate the work, you know, in to everybody so everybody has work and reallocate the resources in such a way that everybody's got enough to live on if it would be easy to produce that? I mean, it sounds to me like we have a really inefficient system. If doing that, this seems inconceivable to us.
Well, I think one of the problems is that the financialization of the economy is growing. I think it's over 60% now. And essentially, you have to question whether Wall Street is really all about extracting wealth, not creating wealth.
You know, exactly.
At least the 19th century.
I call it managerial feudalism.
Well, that's a great title. I mean, at least the 19th century robber barons created stuff. And even Henry Ford.
Yeah, at least they made steel, they made cars, they extracted oil, they did some things.
Right, and even Henry Ford, who was a terrible reactionary, understood that his workers had to be paid enough to buy his product. So the idea that a bunch of sociopathic traders on Wall Street using high-speed computers and people like Robert Mercer can become rich as a result of that kind of computerized trading and creating algorithms is extraordinary. And these are the new robber barons.
Yeah. And it works in a different way. Because, as you say, the old robber barons, at least they made stuff. Now, the new robber barons, I think it really creates a different kind of dynamic. Because if you're just extracting rents or creating debt, I mean, when people say finance, what do they mean? They mean other people's debts. That means trading and otherwise marketing or manipulating other people's debts. And debt has to be created. So it's all done in collusion with government. But the thing is, you know, sure, if you're a capitalist firm competing to make cars, you're not going to hire people you don't need because you've got a profit margin. The dynamic is such that it would be a stupid thing to do. However, if you're like a gigantic financial company and banks, insurance, the fire sector in general is arguably the worst in terms of creation of BS jobs. You know, if you're one of those guys, well, actually, it's a lot more like feudalism. You know, you're extracting money and then redistributing it again. And if you do that, well, it makes perfect sense to hire as many feudal retainers as possible because that absorbs the money that you're extracting before it, you know, and buys you political loyalty so you can continue to do so, before it reaches whoever it is you're supposed to be paying it out to.
Well, David Graeber, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's been a real pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with David Graeber. He's a professor of anthropology at the London School of Economics. He's the author of Debt, The First 5,000 Years, and a contributor to Harper's, The Guardian, and The Baffler. And his latest book just out is BS Jobs, A Theory. And he joined us from London. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into today's barrage of petulant protestations in tweets from Trump claiming he has the absolute right to pardon himself. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Brian Colt, who is the Harold Norris Faculty Scholar and Professor of Law at Michigan State University, the author of Constitutional Cliffhangers, A Legal Guide for Presidents and Their Enemies. He has an article at Foreign Policy, Can Trump Pardon Himself? Welcome to Background Briefing, Brian Colt.
Thanks for having me.
And Brian, I need to add that the article I referred to in Foreign Policy that you wrote, Can Trump Pardon Himself, was written over a year ago, but it has come back with a vengeance, I might say, with tweets from Donald Trump today.
Yes, it's the gift that keeps on giving. But I've actually been writing about this since 1996, so I'm used to recycling my old writing on this.
And just to read Trump's tweet today, as has been stated by numerous legal scholars, I have the absolute right to pardon, in caps, myself. But why would I do that when I have done nothing wrong? In the meantime, the never-ending witch hunt led by 13 very angry and conflicted Democrats and others continues into the midterm. So do you want to go through that and correct all the errors?
Well, it's hard to know where to start with that, although I have to say the nature of the question about self-pardons is that it's pretty easy for anyone to say anything. I will give the president credit for not saying that there was a consensus among legal scholars, because there's not. There are some people who have looked at this who have said that the president does have the power to pardon himself. I happen to disagree, but there are arguments on both sides, and until there's an actual case, we won't know for sure. So, okay, numerous legal scholars, that's true, but there are probably more legal scholars on the other side that say that he does not have the power to pardon himself. Why would I do that when I have done nothing wrong? Well, that actually, again, is not entirely off base. It's a political question, though. What he's saying is that a pardon would be awkward if politically it made him look like he had something to hide. But legally, there are sometimes occasions in which you might want to pardon someone who you don't think has done anything wrong. And so if he wanted to, as in the next sentence he's talking about the never-ending witch hunt and the angry and conflicted Democrats and others, if it got to the point where it was looking like he was about to get indicted, either they would try to do it while he's in office or more likely waiting until he's gone, if he thought that something unfair was being done against him and he had the power to stop it, he could do that. And in doing it, he could say, I'm not doing this because I've done anything wrong. I'm doing this because I haven't done anything wrong. These folks pursuing me are the ones doing something wrong. And I have the power to stop them, and I'm going to use that power. He could do that.
Right, but the whole point of the Mueller inquiry is to find out whether he's done something wrong. And if he stops the Mueller inquiry, of course it will seem that he has done nothing wrong, because we won't find out what, in fact, he has done wrong.
Well, that's not entirely true, because the Mueller inquiry could continue even if President Trump pardons everyone so that there's no possibility of a federal prosecution. There are still two sources of potential investigation. It wouldn't necessarily be Mueller, but they could certainly use whatever he's come up with and pick up where he's left off. And the first would be state prosecutors. The pardon power can't touch state prosecutions or the state criminal process. And the second is Congress. Congress, through its power of oversight, through its impeachment power, could investigate and dig as deep as they want. It might not look that encouraging right now, given Congress's lack of interest in investigating the president, but Congress won't always be constituted the way it is now. And in fact, this is a different chapter of my book than the one on self-pardons, but they could even impeach him after he's left office if if they wanted to do that as a way of vindicating their ability to find out what happened.
And, of course, the 13 angry Democrats, the actual people in charge of the Mueller inquiry, are Mueller, a lifelong Republican, Rosenstein, a lifelong Republican, and the head of the FBI, Christopher Wray, a lifelong Republican. But the point you made about the states could pick up if Mueller was closed down, it's a little ironic, is it not, that after you've been pardoned, if the president did pardon all of those that have been indicted by Mueller or will be indicted by him, if he did pardon them and the case is moved to the states, you can't plead the Fifth Amendment after you've been pardoned, right?
Well, that's not quite right, because if you still face the possibility of criminal prosecution by the states, then you would still be able to refuse to testify on the grounds that it might incriminate you in the states. But if that possibility is removed somehow, then yes, it does reduce the protection, because the witnesses then have to testify. Now, what they say when they testify is another matter, but it does reduce that. And depending on when in the process the pardons come, right, if someone is put on trial and they've impaneled a jury, and there's a lot of technicalities here, but he could time the pardon in such a way that it would knock down the possibility of a state prosecution as well because of double jeopardy. And in that instance, yes, it would be saving them from state prosecution, but at the same time preventing them from refusing to testify.
And again, I'm speaking with Brian Colt, who's the Harold Norris Faculty Scholar and Professor of Law at Michigan State University and the author of Constitutional Cliffhangers, A Legal Guide for Presidents and Their Enemies. And he has an article in Foreign Policy, Can Trump Pardon Himself? Now, a letter, of course, was obtained by the New York Times from Trump's legal team, which was sent to Robert Mueller, arguing that, quote, it remains our position that the president's actions here, by virtue of the position of his position as the chief law enforcement officer, could neither constitutionally nor legally constitute obstruction, because that would amount to him obstructing himself, and that he could, if he wished, terminate the inquiry or even exercise his power of pardon if he so desired. What's your response to Trump's lawyers' claims? I think that was back in November that they sent that letter.
Well, I think that's probably a bit too broad to put it that way. I don't know who else would be arguing it more aggressively than the president's own lawyers, though, right? Like, we shouldn't be surprised that the most extensive view of presidential power, the most extensive view of presidential immunity, would be asserted by the people defending the president. The prosecutors who would be attempting to continue on with the case, to the extent that he allows it, would take a dimmer view of that. If he did try to stop investigations, because he is that of the executive branch, and he can fire all of these people, then there are remedies for that. It's true that presidents have a lot of power to control who gets investigated and who doesn't. Usually, we don't see that because there's a tradition that the Department of Justice is insulated from presidential control. That's not as a matter of constitutional requirement. That's just as a matter of best practices. That's the way it's ideally done and has been done for the most part for recent decades. But the president constitutionally does have the power to push around the attorney general, to push around senior Justice Department officials, to pardon people. It's true. He would pay a political price for that, and that's the remedy. That's the system the Constitution sets up. The president has the power to do this, and if Congress doesn't like it, they can impeach. If Congress doesn't act and the people don't like that, then they can punish Congress. If that doesn't work, well, then there's not a lot we can do about it, unfortunately. And the president has a lot of power to get away with things if Congress and the people as a whole let him.
Well, of course, Donald Trump's new TV lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, was all over the talk shows on the weekend making his case, or making the president's case. This talking about self-pardoning. And, of course, this has prompted Senator Charles Grassley, the Republican chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, to say, if I were president of the United States and I had a lawyer that told me I could pardon myself, I think I would hire a new lawyer. What did you make of that?
Well, again, I would expect a lawyer zealously representing his client to take the strongest position he could. In fact, this all happened before when President Nixon was in trouble and he was considering what to do. He asked his lawyer, what are my options? And one of the options his own lawyer said was that he could pardon himself. He decided that that wouldn't be a very good idea, but his lawyer told him he could do it. And maybe his lawyer also told him why it wouldn't be a very good idea. But at the same time, the prosecutors, right, the Department of Justice looking at this, had a memo that said that he couldn't. And that's what we would expect from the prosecutors, the strongest view that he couldn't. The pardon power is very extensive. If the pardon power doesn't extend to self-pardons, it's one of only a small number of exceptions to the pardon power. The check on it, again, is political. That's why the president has the pardon power, because he's politically accountable. And if he's willing to pay the political price for a pardon, like when Ford pardoned Nixon and it cost him the election in 1976, then that's the way it's supposed to work. What's disturbing to me about the possibility of a self-pardon is that because of the political cost it would present, the most likely context in which a president would be pardoning himself would be on his way out the door. In fact, that's what Nixon was contemplating, pardoning himself and then resigning was what his lawyer suggested one of his options was. If the president pardons himself on his way out the door, that's at the moment when he's least accountable politically. Impeachment, technically you can still impeach him after he's left office, but you can't remove him from office through impeachment. He's not going to be running for election again. Then again, the political cost doesn't really loom as large. And I think that's a defect in the constitutional structure, but it is what it is.
Well, Brian Colt, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Brian Colt, who's the Harold Norris Faculty Scholar and Professor of Law at Michigan State University and the author of Constitutional Cliffhangers, A Legal Guide for Presidents and Their Enemies. And he has an article at Foreign Policy, Can Trump Pardon Himself? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Alejandra Lariva-Latt. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.